It truly is a privilege this morning to introduce our guest speaker to you. Served the Lord in Afghanistan for over 30 years. This last year, when her husband was murdered in Afghanistan, she was forced into the spotlight. But I remember hearing her speak almost 15 years ago when I was a grad student at the Urbana Missions Conference. As she got up to speak, and as she began talking about her husband and her family, I remember thinking, wow, she's just a soccer mom. Of course, she was a soccer mom who happened to live in Afghanistan, a pretty hardcore soccer mom. Her life and her testimony back then and today is a credit to how God uses ordinary people, because He is an extraordinary God. The last time she visited Park Street was 40 years ago when she was a college student. This morning, we are so glad to have her back as our guest speaker. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by saying thank you to God for Park Street Church. 40 years ago, when my husband was a student at Tufts University, he was part of a group called the Tufts Christian Fellowship. And he started coming down here to this church on Sunday evenings. The story goes that one Sunday, actually it was Mission Sunday, like this, like we're in right now, the pastor stood up and announced how much money they would need to meet their mission budget that year. So they took up a collection, and there's a little man sitting down here adding it all up, and it wasn't enough. So they took up another collection, and then they did it again. You know, so I just wanted to warn you. I was told yesterday, however, by the missions chairperson himself that they don't do that anymore. But just so, well, you can relax, huh? These mission conferences are serious about how you use your money. From the time my husband Tom was 10 years old, he was grinding lenses, fitting eyeglasses, and learning how to refract his father's eye patients. His future was all planned out by his dad, an ophthalmologist in upstate New York. Go to medical school, son, move back home, and take over my practice in Hudson. But after finishing university, we actually flew to Afghanistan and began helping a small team of eye specialists run the country's one and only eye hospital. By way of connecting to this mission theme of it's not okay, I guess you could say that Tom felt very deeply it was not okay. It bothered him that while eyeglasses and eye care were becoming a very expensive fashion statement here in America, the majority of Afghan people lacked the most basic eye care. And so the journey of our lifetime began. We never intended to stay in Afghanistan for 30 years. We actually signed up for 2 years. So that's my second warning. These mission conferences are serious events. They are not just concerned about how you spend your money, but what you plan to do with your life. But I'll get back to my story. I was saying that we meant to stay for 2 years and ended up staying for 30. So how did that happen? Wartime does not really offer people, especially people working in healthcare, a very good exit strategy. At first, there was the need for a second eye hospital to start up in the western city of Herat, where the spread of one particular eye disease, trachoma, left whole communities blinded. The road from Herat to Kabul was fraught with robbers and militia, so the entire western region of Afghanistan was in a way cut off from the services given in Kabul. This way, people would not have to travel over that dangerous road. Then, the Soviet Union invaded in 1980. So while men were off fighting the Russians, there was loads of room in the training rooms, in the school rooms, to train Afghan women in eye care. And then when the Russians withdrew in the early 90s, the country sunk into a kind of anarchy. 100 rockets a day was a good day, and after that, we stopped counting. If we left, who would pick up the dead bodies from the street? Our logic came down to that. When the eye hospital was hit with missiles and burned to the ground, little clinics were then needed around the different front lines, of battle. And our kitchen became a temporary pharmacy. How could we leave? By the time the Taliban overthrew everybody else and clamped down with their version of Sharia law, they offered, believe it or not, safe passage to some of the most remote regions of that country, some of the most remote regions in the world, really. For the most part, these were Taliban areas high up in the Hindu Kush Mountains where huge populations of people never see a doctor. Well, my husband, who loved mountains, how could he turn that invitation down? On the other hand, I think I started out seeing mission as a go, give, and get out proposition. We were the goers, we were the givers, and when the going got tough, we would get out. But gradually, very gradually, God helped me to see that that was not the best model for his work. Some of you might say that, well, we just got stuck there. But I think we would prefer to say that we got hooked. Hooked by the warmth and hospitality of ordinary Afghan people. We were hooked by the amazing purposefulness that filled our life and our professions, our marriage, and our children, our family. But it took a few difficult situations for that hook to hold. In the autumn of 1978, we moved with our two young daughters from Kabul to Herat to start that second hospital. Tom's job was to work with the Afghan construction company to finish the hospital and get it open by spring. My job was to be with our two young children and make friends in the neighborhood. Simple enough. But from the start, I felt suspect and unwelcomed. Then the March 1979 uprisings began. Farmers and villagers from Herat rose up and massacred hundreds of Russian advisors and their families who had infiltrated the whole region to prepare for the coming Soviet invasion. In turn, the Afghan military and the Soviets retaliated by bombing the busy bazaars and marketplaces. Our quiet neighborhood turned into a war zone overnight. Sometime during this time of fighting, there was that window of opportunity to escape. The Afghan government arranged for a military convoy to get us and a handful of other foreigners out. Those suspicious and unwelcoming neighbors opened their gates just a crack to see what we would do when that convoy came to pick us up. And we turned it down, and we stayed. That is when I learned an Afghan cultural bottom line. You put yourself out for me, and I'll do the same for you, and more so. That evening, when mobs of angry protesters filled our streets, these same neighbors, those suspicious, unwelcoming neighbors, lay at our gate, motioning for the mobs to pass us by. They protected us. During the following weeks, whenever there was a lull in fighting, our neighbors would invite us to sneak across the street, come into their humble home, get down on the floor, break bread together, and drink their sweet cardamom tea. They fed us. And in an amazing way, they opened their lives to us. God began working wonders. All along, we really did think things would get better. But they only got worse, much worse. The Afghan proverb, Baomed, Dunya, Zendagi, Basha, the world eats hope. Hope is what sustains them. Hope is the food that keeps them alive, they said. And then an Afghan told my husband, Tom, we live off your hopefulness. But believe me, we had lots of reason to lose hope ourselves. As I said, the eye hospital was hit with a barrage of long-range missiles, burned to the ground. Our windows were blown out. We lived behind walls of saggy sandbags. Our roof had gaping holes from rocket-propelled grenades. One of our doctors was gang-raped. Another was kidnapped. Our pharmacist and his wife were ritually murdered in their home with their children present. The long separations for our family were lonely and difficult. Make no mistake, we are not without our own battle wounds. Though it was by all calculations the worst of times, God kept calling and sending people to work there. Now, this is where the fact that I'm a personnel director comes in. Anyone's looking for a job? I have a list. Social or solar energy project experts, specialized farmers, electrical engineers, microfinance people, water engineers, mother-child caregivers, physio, an occupational therapist, mental health workers, all kinds of teachers, trainers, accountants, business development people, even computer geeks. They were all coming. Amazing, wasn't it? It was in the mess of war, that we saw miracles, unplanned, unstrategized, unexpected miracles. I know an Afghan who, from his own safe place, watched one of these foreign nurses day by day run from her safe place to, that was actually like a little bomb shelter, to the local hospital, ducking all the way, you know, to avoid stray bullets. Maybe you don't know, but you do duck. Why are you doing this? He yelled at her. Why do you stay here? And she only had time to say, Jesus, and ran on. That was enough for him. He could not sleep until he heard more. But that's another story. Mission is mutual. Mission is messy. And I'm finding out in this last year that mission is really a mystery. Just over a year ago, on August 5th, 2010, 12 people left Kabul on a mission to Nuristan. That's one of those most remote areas. After driving 2 days over dry riverbeds, hiking over a 16,000-foot pass, 16,000-foot pass into a valley, and after conducting a 2-week medical camp under the most challenging of conditions, on their return, they were ambushed and murdered. We ready? Dr. Karen Wu, general surgeon from the United Kingdom. She was a ballet dancer before she became a surgeon. She came to train women about safe birth procedures. Dan Terry, specialized in peacemaking, liaising with local warring factions. Tom Little, my husband, much loved by the Afghans and foreigners, not nearly as much loved as he was by us, his family. He led this medical mission. Glenn Lapp, intensive care nurse, drawn to troubled areas around the world, volunteering in response to hurricanes and earthquake disasters. He was the one to take over my husband's job in provincial eye care planning. Tom Grams sold his dental practice in Colorado. He and my Tom were going to be the Tom team. Eyes and teeth in Afghanistan. Jawed. Now he was supposed to be the comic relief guy. I know he doesn't look very comical, but Afghans don't like to smile for their photos. But this guy just helped so much on previous eye camps that he just brought humor into really quite challenging situations. Brian Cardarelli, he was the youngest, he was 25 years old, and I remember him at our table in Kabul saying, you know, I'm just so excited to use my videography for God's kingdom. Maybe this is what God has for me. Cheryl Beckett, she's like an angel of mercy. In the women's prisons, you haven't been to a prison until you've been to a prison in Kabul. There, she helped the women start nutritional gardens to grow their own healthy vegetables. Daniela Beyer, a gentle, bright linguist, translating for Dr. Wu's Winman patients. And Mahram Ali, he was the one to guard the vehicles while the others crossed over the mountain passes into the valleys to do the medical camp. After Tom was buried in Kabul, August 2010, the authorities returned his small notebook found at the scene of the crime. His last entry in that notebook was from 2 Corinthians 2:14 that was read to us. For we are to God the aroma of Christ. But in the margin, he had written this little thing, tell the Nuristani goat cheese story. Yeah, I knew all about Nuristani goat cheese from my trip in 1995 to this same valley. Nuristani goat cheese takes some getting used to. Very strong, pungent odor. It's repulsive. The cheese, the animal skin that carries the cheese, the donkey that carries the animal skin, the herdsman who leads the donkey, all were permeated by this horrific smell. It was disgusting. You could smell it coming for miles. No way. I had watched others eat it, and they looked so satisfied, but I didn't want any part of the stuff. That is, not until I got hungry enough. I remember Tom saying to me, you know, Libby, Nuristani goat cheese is to you what the concept of God's grace is to a Nuristani. God laying aside his power, coming to us in weakness, dying on a cross, not a hero's death, not a martyr's death, but a shameful death. What kind of God is that? It was just too much for them to stomach. The Afghans have a proverb, Bibinan Betaras Shunidan. Seeing is always better than hearing. If Tom were here today, I know that he would say God's grace needs to be demonstrated. It needs to be acted out. It is not something to debate and discuss in polite conversations. People need to see God's grace, whether they're from Boston, Bangladesh, or Nuristan. They need to see God's grace. Henry Nouwen writes, the mystery of mission, the mystery of mission is that we have been chosen to make our own limited and very conditional love the gateway for God's unlimited and unconditional love to reach another. The Lausanne Congress on World Mission, held in Cape Town last October, took the story of these 10 who lost their lives, this scripture verse from Paul's letter, and this simple analogy of goat cheese, and framed part of their Lausanne Covenant, which stands as a kind of mission roadmap for the 21st century. I'd like to read that. Quote, "We are the aroma of Christ. Our calling is to live and serve among people of other faiths in a way that is so saturated with the fragrance of Christ, the fragrance of God's grace, that they smell Christ, that they come and taste and see that the Lord is good. When Christians love people of other faiths through lives of love and acts of service, they embody the transforming power of God. In cultures of honor, where shame and vengeance are allied with religious legalism, grace is an alien concept. In these contexts, God's vulnerable, self-giving, self-sacrificing love is not something to be debated. It is much too foreign, even repulsive. Here, grace is an acquired taste over a long time in small doses for those hungry enough to taste it. We long for God to raise up more men and women of grace who will make long-term commitments to live, love, and serve in these tough places, here in Boston, anywhere around the world, to love and serve Jesus Christ in these cultures where it is unwelcome and dangerous to do so." End of quote. So, how many of us will go from this missions conference and hear the stories, and then look around them on their way home, maybe listen to the news tonight? Will we say, "It's not okay. What I see is not okay. Here I am, God. Can you use me to change this?" The late Steve Jobs, Apple CEO, said at a graduating class in 2002, Stanford University, quote, "Remembering that I will be dead soon is the most important tool I have ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or fear of failure, these things fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is most important." I started out by telling you the story of the offering plate passed around second time, third time. That was God's grace. He gives us multiple chances to get it right. Nothing we have is ours. Nothing. Not our money, not our talents, our education, nothing, not even our life is ours. In Him we live and move and have our being. Tom's favorite Afghan proverb was "Katra katra darya mesha," drop by drop, the river is formed. You know, we look at the tragedies. We saw them at the beginning. All those things that are not okay. And we say, gee, you know, what can I offer? It's just a drop in the bucket. Katra katra darya mesha, drop by drop, the river is formed. We see the drop. God sees the river that is formed, his river of life, you know. May your kingdom come, O God, on earth as it is in heaven.